This is the Mueller Russian Two Conclusions panel, if you're in the right place or wrong place. It's panel number 5207. We are, as many of you know, our format is we have four incredible panelists with us. You can't hear us? Is that better? Is that why it says, please speak into the microphone right here on the back of this? Is this okay? I'm going to introduce our panelists in a second, but I am really excited because each of the four represents kind of a different vector into this investigation, and I think we'll get some really interesting insight in the next hour and a half. I'm going to start by reading about the Q&A. We're going to try to save as much time as possible because this is obviously a pretty topical subject. Save as much time as possible for your questions. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the app as well as the note card system to receive questions, which will be fed to me. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session, 5207, Mueller, in the schedule and tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand. Someone just raised their hand. You're the winner. To request a note card and pencil from one of our producers, who will then come and gather your question and feed that to me the old-fashioned way. If you're a student, please note this in your question because we do try to give priority to student questions. And make your questions brief and to the point, and for my sake, legible. And with that, I'd like to introduce our panelists. I'm going to start here on my left, which would probably be about the only time I'd say this about Robert George.
Only in Boulder.
He's a member of the editorial board of the New York Daily News. I guess about 3 years ago you moved there from the Post. Is that about right?
Two years ago.
He's originally from Trinidad. He came here by way of the UK. Interesting story. Were you in college when you had your professor's wife, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, try to get you a volunteer position at the Democratic National Convention in 1988?
Well, I approached the professor and asked about possibly volunteering there while simultaneously talking to a neighbor of mine who was a Republican about volunteering at the Republican convention. One of them said yes, and one of them said no, and the rest is history.
Well, let's say that Kathleen Kennedy Townsend didn't have enough clout to get him a volunteer position at the Democratic National Convention.
Well,
and the rest is history. Yeah,
exactly.
He later became a staffer for Newt Gingrich and now is a very active writer, editorialist, tweeter, blogger, you name it, on politics, where he has a keen interest. And I think you're also a comic book nerd and stand-up comedian, both of which probably help in this political climate, I think.
And it's CWA.
Next to Robert is Susan Block. She is a professor at Georgetown Law. What struck me is that she has testified a number of times in Congress about what is an impeachable offense. She did that before the House Judiciary Committee in 1998. She also testified before the Senate on whether a sitting president can be indicted and tried. Not that that has any relevancy to this discussion. But she clerked for Thurgood Marshall. And
thank you, Behan.
One of the things that really strikes me as a parent, both her children are public defenders. Yes.
Thanks to Thurgood Marshall.
Next to Sue is Lisa Graves, who is a watchdog, probably without peer, on the intersection of politics and media and the influence of corporate money in our politics. Just ask the Koch brothers, her best friends. She's written and blogged quite a bit about them. But early in her career, she actually worked as an assistant attorney general at the DOJ. She worked for the U.S. Senate with the appointment of Article III judges, if I'm not mistaken. and later with the ACLU. She's been a professor at GW Law, and she's now the co-director of Documented, which is a new watchdog focused on corporate influence in our democracy. Our last but not least panelist is Bill Leone. As you could tell, this is not Molly Ball, who unfortunately had to drop and could not make it to Boulder. Bill has been very gracious to join us at the last minute. He is the former U.S. attorney in the District of Colorado, and he has known Bill Mueller for 27 years, worked alongside him. He has known Jim Comey, worked alongside him. He is now the partner and head of the White Collar and Government Investigations Group in New York City for Norton Rose Fulbright, one of the leading international law firms. When he was at the when he was U.S. attorney, he prosecuted a number of high-profile cases, including Joe Nachio's, which I'm sure a lot of us are familiar with. And he's a CU law grad. So with that, especially want to thank him for joining us at the last minute, hence his homemade name tag. With that, I would like to hand it over to Sue, who I think has a good kind of overview summary of the panel and what we're going to be hearing about for the next hour plus. And then I'll have each of the panelists give a short intro, and then we'll start to get into the discussion.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone, for coming. This is a hot topic, and it's one of my favorite topics. I have to say I've always enjoyed teaching constitutional law. It's always been fun, but in the since the last election, it's been particularly intriguing and interesting. President Trump has been a gift to con law professors and comics. I'm in the con law. Right.
Journalists, too.
That's true. Everybody, I guess. So let me start. There's so many intriguing questions, it's hard to know where to start. But Trump has opened up a lot of interesting questions. What is obstruction of justice? Can a president commit a crime? Can a president be indicted while in office? What is collusion? I'm going to try and answer some of those and tell you where we are in the Mueller investigation, and then we'll hear from everyone else. Let me start by just giving you a brief description of what Mueller's doing and how it compares to what Ken Starr was doing. Obviously, both were investigating a sitting president for potential wrongdoing. Starr's role was a little more structured, because he was operating under an existing statute, the independent counsel statute, where he was appointed by judges and he had to report to Congress. But after the Starr investigation, Congress decided it really didn't like that law, and so it let it expire. During the Clinton administration, the Justice Department came up with regulations to deal with issues of when there's potential wrongdoing in the White House. And it's under those regulations that Mueller is operating. And the difference between regulations and a statute is not that significant, except in one important aspect, and that is the security of the position of independent counsel or special counsel. So, for example, it was very, very hard to get rid of Starr. Mueller's position is much more vulnerable, and as we know, President Trump has apparently, word is, that he's talked about getting rid of Mueller in a way that is for Trump much easier than it would have been for Clinton. So what is Mueller's assignment? He's investigating whether there was Russian interference in our election, whether there was collusion. He's also now investigating whether Trump tried to obstruct justice. And there are a number of potential acts that possibly suggest obstruction of justice. They are the following. One, the firing of Comey. And we know that Trump told Lester Holt that he fired Comey because of the Russian investigation. Other evidence is that President Trump, helped Don Jr. come up with an explanation for the Trump Tower meeting. The third possible piece of evidence is that Trump's effort to fire Mueller. That can also be interpreted as an attempt to obstruct justice. And finally, the firing of Andrew McCabe 2 or 3 days before his pension vested, also possible evidence. So some have questioned whether a president can ever be accused of obstructing justice. After all, the president is the head of the Justice Department above the Attorney General. And so some would say, well, he can fire these people whenever he wants. And that's actually true. He can fire Sessions whenever he wants. So can it ever be an evidence of obstruction of justice? I think most of us, but maybe the panel might disagree with me, I don't know. I would say that, yes, the president can be accused and found guilty of obstruction of justice. It is a question of what his intent was when he did the actions. So if he fired any of these people because he wanted to delay or avoid the investigation or impede the investigation, then that would be evidence, in my view, of obstruction of justice. Obviously very hard to prove. Intent is always hard to prove. But it, in my view, is a crime that a president can be found guilty of. And we do know that Nixon and Clinton were accused of obstructing justice. So what's likely to happen with the Mueller investigation? I know all the answers, so I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. I don't know. But it depends. How's that for an answer? It depends on a number of factors. Obviously, I don't think anything will happen until Mueller finishes his investigation and writes his report. Recent evidence suggests he's starting first on obstruction of justice and then moving to collusion. He probably is doing both at the same time. We've just learned that Trump is a subject but not a target of the investigation. But as everyone has pointed out, it's very easy for someone, especially if you go testify before Mueller, it's very easy for someone like Trump or anybody, really, to move from being a subject to a target. As soon as you start lying, you usually cross that line. So there's some controversy about whether Trump should meet with Mueller. John Dowd, the lawyer who just left, thought Trump should avoid going before Mueller. His lawyer now, the other lawyer, Ty Cobb, the one with the mustache. Notable, and I guess now Bolton has a mustache, so you have to get your mustaches straight. Apparently, Cobb thinks it's okay for Trump to testify. That we'll find out. Whatever happens with Trump and Mueller, Mueller will write a report. He will give it to Deputy AG Rod Rosenstein. The reason Rod Rosenstein is guiding and in charge of Mueller is because, as we know, Sessions has recused himself. If Mueller concludes there's evidence of Trump either obstructing justice and or collusion, he'll send this report recommending that Rosenstein send the report to the Congress, where the House can begin impeachment proceedings. Whether the House would do that or not obviously depends on who's in the House at the time. That will be obviously influenced a lot by the elections at the end of this year. Impeachment is a possibility. It is, in my view, a very drastic remedy to be utilized only in extreme circumstances. It does, in some sense, undo an election. It obviously removes the president, impeachment and conviction. It's obviously, impeachment is a two-step process. We can talk about that later. But if you impeach and then convict the president, he's out. So in that sense, it undoes the election. On the other hand, you do get the vice president, and that vice president was obviously elected in the same election. So in that sense, it doesn't undo the election. But it still is a drastic remedy, and I think should be used very rarely. Next quick question is, can a sitting president be indicted? As Jim mentioned, I've testified on that. It's still an open question. Remember the difference between impeachment and indictment. Impeachment is a political remedy utilized by the Congress, the House, and the Senate. House impeaches, Senate has the trial. At the end of it, if the Senate convicts the president, The president is out. There's no mid-ground. You can't say he's guilty, but he can stay. It's if he's guilty, he's out. And the president, the vice president becomes president. It is an important remedy, but it's only a political remedy. The president, or whoever it is that gets impeached and removed, can always be tried criminally after. Can the president be tried while he's in office before he's impeached and removed? My position is no. I don't know if other people up here would disagree with me. We can talk about that. I think you have to remove the president either by impeachment or by the term ending or however, his resigning, whatever it is. I don't think you can or should be able to criminally indict and try a president while the president is in office. As I said, it's an unanswered question. Nixon was an unindicted co-conspirator, so we've never had a president indicted. Let me just see if I've got everything I wanted to say. So that raises to me the next interesting question, which I'll be real quick about, and that's pardons. Can the president can pardon anyone he wants, anytime. He did it this morning with Scooter Libby. But the unanswered question here is, can the president pardon himself? Again, lots of controversy on that. I don't know the answer. We can talk about that later if anyone wants to. Obviously, it has never happened. Many people think that even if he can, if he does do it, that would be a sign of obstruction of justice. And so then we get him the other way, coming and going. But even whatever the president can do with the pardon power, it's really important to remember that the pardon power only pardons someone from federal crimes. It does not have anything to do with state crimes. And chances are that if President Trump and the Trump administration, if they've violated federal law, the chances are good they've also violated state law. And we know that Attorney General for the state of New York, Schneiderman, is investigating state law crimes. And so the Trump people will always be subject to that, regardless of pardons. I'm not saying anything. I'm just telling you the facts.
You report, they decide.
It's all real news. No fake news here. So that's it. That's all I wanted to say about it. I'm obviously happy to answer questions. I just wanted to lay out what the groundwork is, and if we wanted to talk about how impeachment works and all that stuff, I'm here for the duration. Thank you.
Robert, why don't you then take the ball and let's run down the table with it.
I'm going to try and keep my remarks very, very brief because I don't have a law degree, and the my esteemed colleagues here do, and so they can get into some of the minutia that I can't. As a journalist, though, we are sort of trained to look at patterns and connections. Obviously, that happens on the law side as well. But particularly when we're trying to share a story, tell a story that has a whole lot of moving parts and is very, very complicated, we try and just kind of draw certain connections that help the reader or the viewer get a sense of what's going on, or try and at least point the reader in a direction, say, oh, you might want to look at this or you might want to look at that. I do not know if there is a legal cause for Special Counsel Mueller to conclude that there was collusion amongst the Trump campaign and various Russian operatives. I don't know what collusion means in the legal sense. I know many analysts have said that the better phrase is conspiracy, and then trying to figure out exactly what kind of laws may have been broken. So I do not know if there was collusion. But one of the things that always perks the ear up of journalists is when people lie. And when they lie for no apparent other reason than to cover something up that may or may not have been illegal, within the broad Trump circle, these five people have either clearly lied or have actually been forced to take guilty pleas because of their lies. Michael Flynn, George, let me back up. Lying specifically related to their communications and discussions with Russian operatives. Michael Flynn, George Papadopoulos, Jeff Sessions, Donald Trump Jr., and Jared Kushner. And with Jared Kushner, you also have the interestingly or the odd, kind of the odd scenario that he tried to create a secret secure area where he could have communications with Russian operatives. Now, that makes some people think, why would somebody do that? And obviously, that is one thing that Mr. Mueller is looking at. Mr. Kushner has also had to revise and extend his financial statement to the FBI and to the federal government numerous times because he forgot to mention that he was billions of dollars in debt to this foreign entity and that foreign entity. Again, it could happen to anybody, right? So those are the kind of things that, I don't know, maybe it's, and then of course, Donald Trump Jr., I forgot about that meeting in Trump Tower. Again, he's had so many meetings in Trump Tower. This was just one, it just slipped his mind. It just happened to be with these operatives that are connected to Russian intelligence. And by the way, those are probably the top five of individuals within the Trump orbit that have either lied or have forgotten that they met with a Russian ambassador or a Russian operative. So that is something that we can assume that Mr. Mueller is looking at. Why there's a reason why people are lying, and he's probably trying to figure out why that is. The other thing, and Sue mentioned this. This was actually perhaps like the perfect day to have this particular panel, because yesterday Mr. Comey's book was released, which of course gave the president an opportunity to weigh in on it on Mr. Comey this morning. I talked about that at another panel. I'm not going to say exactly what he said, but you guys can guess. He's not too thrilled about that. We also today, and this is very, very relevant, the president pardoned Scooter Libby. Now, that is relevant for a couple of reasons. First of all, Scooter Libby, some people are of the opinion, or not of the opinion, some people thought mistakenly that Scooter Libby was convicted for basically outing Valerie Plame. That's not what happened. The person who actually outed Valerie Plame was Richard Armitage, but Scooter Libby lied about what he knew to the FBI. And special prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald charged and convicted Libby. Now his sentence was commuted by George W. Bush, but he was not pardoned. Trump pardoned him. That is significant because Patrick Fitzgerald was appointed special counsel by James Comey because John Ashcroft had to recuse himself in that. So you've got these fascinating kind of connections going back, 10 years. So the president said in his pardoning statement that a number of people had told him that Scooter Libby had been treated, quote, unfairly. So unfairly is one of Donald Trump's favorite words. He is being treated unfairly by the media. A number of members of his cabinet are being treated unfairly. So he feels that Libby was treated unfairly in that. That could very well be a clue to the state of mind of the president in terms of possibly pardoning others that he feels are being treated unfairly within the current investigation. And so that is something that we should keep an eye on. And finally, we should also keep note. You mentioned former Deputy Director McCabe today. In fact, just a few minutes ago, the Inspector General released his study on the report on his study on McCabe, and that he found that McCabe quote lacked candor on four separate occasions, three under oath, and that is really the reason, the stated reason why McCabe was fired. The timing of that release is rather interesting. McCabe may have made mistakes. It gives the president's side some kind of ammunition that there was some kind of FBI conspiracy going on. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. But that is something to definitely keep in mind. And with that, I think I'll end my remarks and hand it over to one of my legal colleagues over here. Thank you very much.
I was just going to say you gave me a promotion to Assistant Attorney General, but I was actually Deputy Assistant Attorney General on Criminal and Civil Policy at the U.S. Department of Justice under both Janet Reno and John Ashcroft. And in that work, that led me briefly to be at the department as Comey and Mueller were coming into the department. And then I just would say, I guess I wanted to begin with a little bit of background on some of the issues from a slightly different perspective than my colleagues, because I think that there's a so much disinformation out there that it may be important to begin there. But I feel like I should first say that when I look at the Scooter Libby pardon, it strikes me as a signal to people about getting away with basically lying to the prosecutors that you will be pardoned. If you lie to the prosecutors, this is certainly the case in that instance. Scooter Libby was convicted of lying in an investigation. He was duly convicted, righteously convicted. There are people who are currently being interviewed by prosecutors who have information about Donald Trump. I think, to me, this is a very clear signal being sent. But I wanted to sort of step back and talk about this from a couple different perspectives. One is, from my observation of the news, and I'm sure many of you have been watching this all very closely, there's just simply no doubt in my mind that Russia and that Putin were trying to influence, distort our election. The evidence to me is just so manifest that I really could not entertain any doubt myself, any reasonable doubt on that. I think they sought a number of ways to do so. Some of those connections are through, you know, the FSB. Some of those are through some of the oligarchs in Russia. You can see the ways in which there was an effort to distort the information that Americans were receiving about our election through Facebook, through the efforts of Cambridge Analytica, which was working with the Trump team in many respects to advance their digital campaign. You know, where those lines are, who knew what, when, how, those are all questions that I hope will be uncovered and revealed to the American people. But it's quite clear that there was an effort to try to put Putin's thumb on the scale in favor of Trump and against Hillary Clinton. And it's quite clear that there were a number of ways in which that set of operations proceeded, including having operatives reach out to and meet with people who were part of the Trump campaign, including the campaign chairman for Trump during the summer, spring and summer of 2016, the Trump Tower meeting, and more. And those things are real. I think what's also real is that certainly this president has a severe misunderstanding of the Constitution as a whole, the First Amendment in particular, and probably a whole lot of other clauses. But he also has a deep misunderstanding of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, After I left the Justice Department and went to work for on the Hill, I ultimately went to work for the ACLU during the Patriot Act fight, which actually became the fight over the NSA's warrantless wiretapping or electronic eavesdropping program on Americans. And in that work for more than 4 years, I looked intensively at the rules for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act for FISA, FISA that has since been amended. But those rules, to me, and certainly I think to the Congress that created them after the revelations of the spying on Americans that came out during the Nixon administration about spying then and before then, were about how we would use our intelligence services, the weapon of surveillance, these powerful tools, to protect our nation from foreign enemies. And one of the most fundamental parts of that law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, is that those tools can be used against agents of a foreign power, meaning foreign agents, people who are operatives for the FSB, people who are operatives for other governments, people that they come in contact. If you are believed to be cooperating, aiding, and abetting someone who is an agent of a foreign power, which could include a diplomat or could include someone from the intelligence services or someone from a cutout company, you can be a lawful target of the National Security Agency, of our intelligence apparatus, including the parts of the Justice Department and the FBI that examine those things. They are looking at those individuals, monitoring their communications, because they are trying to protect the United States from foreign influences that would disrupt and distort our democracy and make us less safe. And so it's no surprise to me that there would be foreign operatives who would be under surveillance who might be in contact, based on the revelations that we saw, with the Trump administration, and some of those communications could be intercepted as in the due course of those lawful intelligence operations. The suggestion that there was some sort of President Obama specifically targeting Trump and this is somehow this extraordinary political situation is, I think, a lie, one of many lies, but it also misunderstands the nature of our intelligence community in terms of their efforts to try to keep our nation safe from foreign operatives who want to exercise undue influence on whoever. Now, of course, the FBI, who I testified against. I testified against some of the positions that Mueller took. I testified against some of the positions that Comey took. But I never had a doubt about their integrity or their commitment to try to protect our nation from foreign threats. And I would say to you that there's a lot of different issues going on with Donald Trump, a lot of different potential crimes. But certainly, for me personally, one of the things that I think is the most severe is whether our president is compromised, whether he is under the undue influence or unduly deferential to Vladimir Putin. Perhaps the only person of a public nature who has not actually personally criticized, when he, you know, doesn't hesitate to criticize all sorts of people all the time about all sorts of things, the one person that he does not want to personally cross. And I also think that there's so much tremendous information out there. Jane Mayer's excellent profile in The New Yorker on Mr. Steele, I would commend that to you. There's a tremendously important set of work that was prepared by Tom Adams and Dennis Aftergut, a former federal prosecutor, about money laundering and RICO and Trump's pattern of these hotels and these hotel deals abroad and what that may have meant in terms of his working with foreign crime operatives or his team being in league with money laundering operations of many of Putin's closest allies, along with other people who from other countries who have been up to all sorts of no good. And I think that it's very important that we recognize, from my point of view, even with the partisan divide in this country, and even though I am personally not a fan of Jeff Sessions, there are people who are in law enforcement, in the Justice Department, in the investigation, on Robert Mueller's team, who are devoted to protecting the rule of law in this country. And it is under assault by this president. Whether that results in a criminal conviction for him and others who have collaborated or conspired with him under RICO theory, whether that involves the investigation by the House Intelligence Committee when it is duly in my hope, my personal hope, where when the House Permanent Select Intelligence Committee is no longer led by Devin Nunes, who has compromised himself, and in my view is unworthy of being in a position of responsibility, of oversight over the intelligence community, whether that involves ultimately civil or criminal, state or federal consequences, I hope that the rule of law is vindicated. And we cannot go back to a period in which the president and the president's men, as with Nixon and his closest advisors, asserted that when the president does it, it is the law.
I'm pretty sure I'm the establishment member of this panel today. So... I'd like to sound a note of caution today, and let me tell you a couple of stories about why I think that, and we'll have plenty of time as we go through this afternoon with questions and answers to understand what I'm about to say. And let me start by saying I think I'm a reasonably good lawyer, and I'm a terrible politician, and I'm going to prove that to you this afternoon. I'm going to tell you two stories about that. The first story, you're not a party, and the second one, you are. The first story is years ago when John McCain was running for president and I was one of the last standing moderate Republicans in the country. I was all in for John McCain, campaigning for him, and till the day that he appointed Sarah Palin as his running mate, and I tore my yard sign out of my yard and I put it in the garage. And I went down to my mother's house to have lunch, and she and my father lived east of Pueblo, the Arkansas Valley, and what they were fondly called God's country. And there were about 25 town folk from Fowler, Colorado, there at lunch, and I was there. And I'm one of seven children, okay? And I won't tell you about all my brothers and sisters, but I have one brother who's sort of my evil opposite twin, sort of like my Lazarus twin. And, I have four children and was... put in the United States Attorney's Office during a Republican administration. My brother and his wife are both PhD psychologists. They have matching BMWs, hairless cats, and no children. So you sort of see the opposite image. And so we were having lunch, and I was the betrayal of the Palin nomination was fresh on my mind, and I launched into a rousing indictment of this and was raging. And as the good trial lawyer that I am, after 15 seconds of raging, I realized I had offended everyone at the table except for my brother and his wife. And at that moment, I knocked myself on the head and said, I get it. I think I'm beginning to understand the culture war that's present in our country, and I think I'm beginning to understand better what's happening in our country. But it didn't stop me. And so I managed to offend everyone at the table for the ensuing 30 minutes. I'm going to offend everyone in this room because I know what you want to hear today. And I can tell from the audience reaction, if I were a jury lawyer, I am a jury, I would know exactly what I needed to say today to get your vote, but I'm not going to say it. Many of you I recognize as some old friends and partners are here. Some of you I spoke to when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office and would come up here and debate the ACLU about the Patriot Act. And we would talk about what it meant to put that kind of power in the hands of the government. And the note of caution I want to sound today is that rule of law cuts both ways. Sometimes it helps you get what you want, and sometimes it prevents you from getting what you want. And I'm a rule of law guy. And I noticed there was some little applause when I was introduced as the guy who prosecuted Joe Nacho and defended retirees and investors in a terrible securities fraud and insider trading scheme. That was rule of law at work, and you liked it. Right now, and I'm going to duck after I say this, I also represented the Dakota Access Pipeline Consortium. And we went to court. We went to court in Washington, D.C., in front of Judge Boasberg, who sits on the FISA court and one of the smartest judges in the land. And we presented the true facts of that case. And I'm going to tell you one story about a false fact in that case, not because I'm trying to convince you of the righteousness of that position, but because I want you to really think about what you know and what you don't know and why we have a rule of law in this country. We won that case in the court. When all the evidence was presented and all of the evidence was scrutinized and tested in a court of law under oath with affidavits and physical inspection, the facts were 180 degrees opposite to what you read in the newspaper. The most telling example of that was the worst day of that case in the life of that case was the day that on the internet there appeared a picture of a little 5-year-old girl with her face scarred and bloody, and the headline was that this girl had been mauled by guard dogs at a pipeline location in North Dakota, and that this was the evidence of the evilness of this pipeline company. And that afternoon, the group that ran that ad, Democracy Now!, collected $4 to $5 million in contributions. I found that picture on the internet, but it wasn't from Labor Day of last year. It was from 7 years ago. And that little girl had been in a parking lot in a shopping center in San Antonio, and her parents had locked a dog in that car for 3 hours that afternoon in 100-degree San Antonio heat. And that girl had been injured when they opened the door, and the dog leapt out of the car and bit her on the face. Now, that was a fact that we could get at in a court of law, where you present the evidence, both sides are represented, and you can get to the true facts. In the world we live in right now, we try cases on the internet. We try cases in the headlines. We try cases based on speculation, and we receive and we filter information according to what we want the truth to be and what we expect the truth to be. That is not the way to make sound decisions in this country. And so I really hope that as we go through the discussion today, we sort out what it is that we hope to be true, that we want to be true, that we're willing and ready to believe from what we can actually prove. And I'm going to close this sound of caution by bringing it back to the Mueller investigation, by the way. It's spelled Mueller, but it's pronounced Mueller, Bob Mueller. And it pains me in some ways to listen to this debate and watch the news every night because most of these people are people that I know and respect. I think the world of Bob Mueller. I think the world of Jim Comey. Jim Comey is one of the finest public servants that you'll find anywhere. And he's been impaled by both sides now. He's been impaled by Democrats who think he misbehaved prior to the election. He's been impaled by Republicans who think he misbehaved after the election. He really is a fine man and a dedicated public servant. Pat Fitzgerald was a dedicated prosecutor, sort of a monkish figure who was really dedicated to the rule of law. I thought I was a really great prosecutor, but there is a hazard in prosecution. And the FBI is not immune from it. Prosecutors are not immune from it. The people in this audience are not immune from it. And the hazard is if you set your target too soon and you don't maintain an independent state of mind and you decide early that you're going to reach a result, you will find a way to reach that result. It's very, very important in these cases and in this kind of a prosecution that you not measure your success and your failure based on whether or not you get the scalp or get the conviction. That is to me the worst abomination of the rule of law. Having gotten some clapping, I'm going to stop right there, as any good trial lawyer.
Quit while you're ahead, right?
Yeah.
Well, as you can see, we have nothing more to talk about today. You know, to me, and Sue, I believe you brought it up, Schneiderman, he's a wild card in this whole thing because, you know, it's kind of futile and depressing almost to think about Trump's unfettered ability to throw around pardons, to continue to obstruct justice potentially as the head of the Justice Department, or ultimate head of the Justice Department. So it kind of gets depressing sometimes thinking about, well, where does this go? But Schneiderman is unaffected by that. And so I, my question about Schneiderman is, does he have to run a completely independent investigation, or does he get to piggyback off of any of Mueller's work? For any of, for this is for all of you.
I get, let me see if I can rephrase it. So I guess the question you're asking is, if for some reason Mueller can't...
Gets shut down
in some way, what happens with all the work he's done? And I think there are at least two answers to that. One, he's doing an investigation for the FBI, so the FBI still is going to be running, I mean operating, and they can continue. I don't know who would lead it, but it still can stay in the Justice Department. So that may just continue on its own, unless, of course, Sessions or someone else really does shut it down. But that information is collected and it's there, and I don't think it'll disappear. But then the second question is, all right, Schneiderman is doing, he's the state, he's New York's Attorney General, and he's doing his own investigation in New York. I don't know that there's any way, and maybe you guys know better, if how he, whether or not he can access the federal information or not. But one other point is, even if Mueller gets shut down, the work that
Rosenstein and Guildenstern, yes.
Yes.
This is a soap opera. This is an opera. It's an opera.
Could be a tragedy, too.
It's definitely a tragedy. By Rosenstein setting the investigation to the New York office to investigate under Cohn's operation, that too will continue without regard to what happens to Mueller. So I think there are a lot of different investigations going on with a number of different heads, and chopping off one head won't stop it.
I've been following this a little bit because Eric Schneiderman is my attorney general in New York. And not only would it's clear the investigation or one aspect of the investigation would continue regardless of Mueller, because Mueller and Schneiderman have been collaborating since the middle of last year, specifically related to Paul Manafort's financial transactions. So there's one large part of what Mueller is doing that is already under Schneiderman's purview. Schneiderman's investigators are working side by side with Mueller's investigations. So you know that's a very easy handoff. In addition to that, Schneiderman has also been separately for about a year and a half investigating other aspects of the Trump business empire. He was the one who was pursuing when the president-elect settled the Trump University case before inauguration day. It was via the New York Attorney General. So there's already a potential case pending if certain aspects of what Mueller is doing that Schneiderman will jump in the very second that happens.
I think that there are a number of really complex issues, in part because it's clear from the indictments that a grand jury has been convened, and there are special rules that govern the secrecy of materials presented to a grand jury and materials that are gathered as part of an investigation with which the federal investigations are that are subject to a grand jury. And so I don't know what would happen with all of that evidence, and I don't know how much has actually been shared or could be shared, especially if there aren't, you know, when there are different federal statute at issue versus state statutes at issue. And so I think it's a complex matter what would happen from a legal standpoint. But I would say from a personal standpoint, I hope that if there were a firing of a prosecutor that people would walk out and stand up and speak out and be heard and say this is not acceptable in our country. Even though there's a legal authority to fire a prosecutor under these circumstances, with this amount of evidence that has at least been presented in the public arena surrounding the president, it would be highly inappropriate to fire and obstruct this investigation in that way, in my view. And I just would say to Bill, with regard to the power of a trial to mete out justice versus the very many faults of the media, of trying things in the media, I would embrace and look forward to having people testify under oath in a trial and have people be able to see that testimony.
Yeah, my own view of this is that this investigation goes on regardless of what the venue is for the investigation. Congress really has stood down so far for the most part. I would not expect that to continue if the special prosecutor went away. I've been involved in some of these parallel proceedings where you have civil litigation, the congressional hearing, the criminal prosecution, and although Lisa's absolutely right, there are some limits procedurally on what can be shared from a grand jury to others. The underlying information is not secret simply because it went to a grand jury. The fact that it went to a grand jury remains secret, but the information can be obtained through lots of different places, and lots of different people have the authority to subpoena it. So my expectation would be that the investigation will go on. Really, the question to me, and this is back to my note of caution, is not will the investigation go on, but what will be investigated and what is being investigated? I love the collusion issue that was raised, and I finally saw a really great article on this in it must have been the Wall Street Journal, a couple of weeks ago, but I'm just speaking as a federal prosecutor and a 37-year practitioner. I don't know what it is. It's not a crime. There's no crime in the federal criminal code for collusion for anything. There's lots of good collusion. Pretty sure the people that put this conference on colluded to get it done. The only question, the question is really, was there a crime committed and who is a participant in that crime? And you can be a participant in the crime lots of ways. You can commit the crime, you can aid it, you can abet it, you can assist it, you can enter into an agreement to have it done, you can accept the benefits of it with knowledge that a crime was committed. There's lots of different theories there, but you have to start with a fundamental premise, which was a crime committed. I have to tell you, I didn't know that it was illegal for foreign interests to make contributions to U.S. campaigns. Maybe it's because I grew up in the age of the CIA and the cult of intelligence. I just thought that's what governments do, is you go around the world influencing elections. But I...
Wait, can I jump in on that just sure. briefly, if that's all right? So, it's certainly illegal. I mean, it's a bar on federal campaign finance laws for a foreign person to make a donation to a campaign. You have to sign when you make a donation that you are a U.S. citizen or that you are a U.S. resident, that you're not a foreign national. But the question of foreign influence, it's certainly the case the United States has influenced and sought to disrupt other elections in other countries. I suspect that those countries would perceive that to be criminal and intrusive of their sovereignty. The idea that Russia was trying to distort our election, I think, is an affront to our sovereignty. And I suspect that there may, in fact, be criminal violations that were part of that. And there certainly appears to be a desperate attempt by this White House and some of its former advisors to hide the truth or lie about what those meetings were about and what they're trying to do. And quite frankly, I was remiss in not saying the idea that Jared Kushner, brother, son-in-law or whatever, that any person acting as an agent for the president or basically under his authority would actually go around our intelligence community to try to create a separate channel with Russia through Russia, through the Russian ambassador's office in Washington, D.C., is astounding to me. That's unprecedented behavior. It's extraordinarily risky to have those communications in the hands of the Russians and not have the advice of our intelligence community in terms of dealing with a foreign power of that nature. To me, I mean, that in and of itself is extremely worrisome and troubling, and who knows what those communications were really going to be about, given the business interests of Jared Kushner himself, but also of the president and the Trump organization.
Two quick points. I agree 100% with what you just said. Though, remarkably enough, that might not even be the worst thing Jared Kushner has done. No, I mean, and this is not something that under Mueller's purview. But Jared Kushner, who until several weeks ago had a temporary high level security clearance in the White House. There is reporting on this, and there is supposition that because he had this high level security, he had access to the president's daily brief, taking information from that daily brief. He went over to Saudi Arabia and told the head of the Saudis, these are the people that we have actually figured out who are actually maybe not necessarily loyal to you. And it was just within a few weeks after Kushner's visit, all of these Saudi royals were rounded up on rather spurious charges. Now, I have no brief for these Saudi royals, but I mean that is a remarkably it's not necessarily treasonous, but it is incredibly, incredibly disturbing. And this is the president's son-in-law that that did that. That's number one. Number two, if we don't really know exactly what Mueller is going to conclude, and we do have this whole issue of, you know, if collusion is a crime, as Bill just pointed out. But one of the things that I think could ultimately be very good for the country, for our democracy, is that the special counsel, in addition to obviously he has ability to bring charges, and he's done that in numerous cases already. The special counsel will deliver a report. He will deliver a report to Congress, and that will be quite possibly our clearest example of exactly what happened in 2016. In all this, we know that the Russians were meddling.
Will that report be fully public?
That's a good question.
That's
not
a question a lot of audience members have asked.
Actually, I know the answer to that.
Oh, okay.
The report is actually going to go to Rosenstein, who then can do whatever he wants with it, including nothing, I believe. But he can turn it over to Congress, but he doesn't have to, which is a big difference between what Ken Starr was doing and what Mueller's doing. So it's possible. I can't imagine Mueller giving Rosenstein a report that reveals crimes and Rosenstein saying, oh, I think I'm just going to sit on this and never do anything with it. I mean, we all know someday that report will become public, and Rosenstein doesn't want to be the one who sat on it. So my guess is Rosenstein will turn it over to Congress.
Assuming Rosenstein is in that position
exactly.
At that time.
Right.
Exactly. But whoever's in that position, I still believe. But legally, the report goes to Rosenstein or his replacement, if there is a replacement. And then the law or the regulations do not require that he do anything with it.
Politically, though, it would be very, very difficult.
I totally agree.
For not to.
I was just going to say one thing
in
response to Bill. It is true that collusion is not a crime, and it is sort of this, I don't know where the word came from, and Trump is, you know, very vocal in saying there's no collusion. Collusion is not a crime, but conspiracy to interfere with our elections, I believe, is. And conspiracy to and obstruction of justice is a crime. So there are real live crimes that are being investigated for which, you know, we think there might be evidence. We don't know. And this collusion term is a bit of a red herring, and I think it does divert us. And we probably ought to stop using it because it doesn't do either side any good. Just talk conspiracy.
Good.
Oh, I got a pen.
So, So with that, let's turn to your questions. I think I got two or three. but before we get there, I'm going to read a public service announcement on behalf of the CWA. I'd like to mention that this is our 70th year crowdfunding campaign. And to celebrate the 70th year, we have set a goal to raise 70,000 smackaroos. We are a quarter of the way toward that goal, and we would appreciate your support. Any amount helps. And conveniently, you may give by selecting the donate button in your app or visiting the CWA website or giving me the money after.
Stole
my joke.
Yeah, yeah, or any of us, yes. Since the CWA doesn't pay honoraria, right?
Thank you for reminding us of that.
You know, here's an interesting question. If Trump is, if he's been money laundering, if he's been paying or having either Michael Cohen or Roy Cohn prior to that to do his bidding for him, there's been a lot of smoke with Donald Trump for many, many years. This is not a guy who burst onto our national scene. And by the way, I'm kind of embellishing the question a little bit. Why hasn't he been investigated prior to this? I mean, if there's so much smoke there.
Who?
I think we don't know
that he hasn't, but yeah. I'll defer to Bill on this, or at least.
I would just say, you know, I think this happens a lot with politicians. There are a lot of people who are business people who have been doing a lot of things, and people haven't paid that much attention to whether they're doing it lawfully or not, unless you can sort of see a harm. I mean, certainly Donald Trump has been subject to numerous lawsuits for cheating people out of contracts and a whole array of other sorts of maneuvers and bankruptcy. But I don't know that. I mean, certainly there is the situation with Felix Sater. That you know was a subject of investigation, criminal investigation. If you want to read more about that, that is in Tom Adams and Dennis Aftergut's piece, but it's also discussed in a number of articles if you want to look him up. I mean, so there certainly was an investigation that started to get into some of these money laundering things. Of course, at the time, Trump said something like, I don't know, I have only rarely remember the guy who was so intimately involved in his business dealings. And in fact, when I looked into some of these issues, you could see that this relationship was very much an ongoing relationship. So I guess I would challenge that question that there's been no examination of money laundering. I think there's been a lot of concerns, perhaps, about it. There may have been other people looking into it. There have been a lot of complaints in other countries. There's an ongoing dispute in Panama, or at least you know a dispute that's continuing in Panama. There are other disputes in former Soviet republics. I think that, like as with many people who enter public life, sometimes until there is the scrutiny of the press on their activities, people don't know what their real background truly is, other than what they tell you their background is. And so that's what happens in our political system: is that people become subject to scrutiny, and they look into whether this is true or not, and what those dealings were, and what the profits were, or what who their partners were, and then we discover that this person is a crook or is crooked. So that happens.
He might regret having ever run.
So
here's
another question. In fact, this has been asked by a number of people. There were a lot of questions about all the talk about the legislative protection potentially from Mueller. I saw Lindsey Graham on the news the other night said that if he were to fire Mueller, it would be the beginning of the end of his administration. That was his quote. Grassley's come out. A number of Republicans have come out. So one question is, can Trump just simply veto that legislation should they even pass it? So, I mean, is that also futile and depressing to think about? He could pardon himself that way. Or is there actually something Congress can do? And if so, is there the political will on the part of the Republicans to do it?
Well, I mean, the latter, that last question is key here. So far, the answer appears to have been no. I mean, on the Senate side, you've got a fairly conservative senator from North Carolina, Tom Tillis, who is sort of crafting, you know, sort of a Mueller Special Counsel Protection Act, But even Charles Grassley, who has made clear signals, sent clear signals to the White House, you know, not to even think about it, he and the ranking member, Dianne Feinstein, have been sort of fighting over how to present sort of Mueller protection legislation. If a Republican bill in the Senate protecting Mueller would likely pass with a veto-proof majority. However, I don't believe there would be even if it passed in the House. I think the House would end up sustaining the veto. So it's a jump ball at this point.
It is true that the House and the Senate are talking about it. I don't think there's the will, as Robert said. In answer to your question, Jim, yes, the president could veto it. But I don't know if such legislation is really necessary. The regulations provide that the special counsel can only be removed, so-called for cause, for doing something wrong, some kind of, doing something wrong. And so if Mueller were to be fired by whoever is in charge, I mean, now it's Rosenstein, but we have to contemplate that Rosenstein may get the axe. They're talking more and more about doing that. But if Mueller does get fired somehow, he can contest that and say that there was no cause. And that can go to court. And the courts can decide whether or not there was justifiable cause for removing him. So I'm not sure that this legislation that's being talked about is actually necessary.
I guess I would just add, speaking personally, I know that there's all, you know, you hear these talks about the perils of divided government, but one of the benefits of divided government is that you have branches that might actually check each other in our co-equal system of government. And in some ways, you know, one check on a president is to have a opposite party in charge of one house that can issue subpoenas and do an investigation and has the will to do so, and not to do so vindictively, but with a devotion to the Constitution. That happened, in my view, during the Nixon impeachment hearings. That was a bipartisan effort by people who were statesmen and stateswomen, but statesmen predominantly, who put country above party, not just a slogan, but for real.
And so, therefore, this November 2018 is very important.
Here's a question I hadn't thought about. Suppose Mueller wraps up his investigation, delivers his report, and it doesn't involve Russia, but other crimes or high crimes and misdemeanors or whatever he may find. Can Sessions unrecuse himself at that point? Because I think the background of the question.
Why would he want to?
Yeah, I don't know why it matters.
Well, no, I think the background to the question is Sessions recused himself ostensibly
because
of the Russia part. Right. So can he unrecuse himself at that point, regardless of whether he would? Yeah.
I think what would happen. If I understand the question is, if once Mueller's done and he writes his report, and in the report there's something about no collusion or no conspiracy with Russia, but there's money laundering or there's some other bad thing that has nothing to do with Russia, I guess I don't know what it would mean for Sessions to recuse himself.
Well, he would the charges. He would have direct influence. That was the other part of the question.
I think it's a great question. I guess my answer would be the report would still go to Rosenstein. Rosenstein would read it, and I guess if there's the word Russia, if there's nothing about Russia in it, he could share it with Sessions. But still the main question, regardless of who in the Justice Department is making this decision, the question is, does it go to the Congress? And my guess is whoever gets the report, whether it stops with Rosenstein or gets shared with Sessions, I would think they would share it with the Congress.
And keep in mind, Jeff Sessions, who has officially speaking recused himself from oversight of things with Russia, has asked the Utah U.S. attorney to look into the FBI's handling of the dossier with respect to the investigation of Carter Page, and he also there's another special not special counsel but another lawyer that he's also looked into. So he's technically speaking recused himself on Russia things, but he's also involved himself with a couple of other cases which are tangential to the FBI and other oversight. So that's something that should be factored into this question as well.
And there's also the possibility of him firing Sessions and firing Rod Rosenstein. And, you know, we're in this whole new world where things that people thought might not be possible, that a president might not do, might never do, you know, we're way past that Rubicon in lots of ways.
Well, and Scott Pruitt has kind of partly screwed up that plan, because one of the plans under discussion was he fires Sessions and then he makes Scott Pruitt acting attorney general. But Mr. Pruitt is having difficulty with his rent right now, so.
Bill has.
Did you want some?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, speaking of doing things that are sort of you'd never thought possible, I have the disadvantage of having just finished reading the McCulloch Truman biography. Yeah. I didn't think you could nationalize the entire steel industry. that happened, and the Supreme Court.
It was a time of war.
Fortunately, intervened. But anyway, look, you've raised the question about what happens if the special prosecutor comes back and doesn't have anything to say about Russian interference with the election. I agree with Lisa that anything that taints the functioning of our democracy and makes it not work very well is really important, and I think that's something that needs to be investigated. Although Alan Dershowitz and I don't agree on a lot of things, I kind of agree with Alan Dershowitz that a 9/11 style commission would have been a great way to get at the bottom of this and help us move forward with how to sort of harden our electoral process from that kind of interference. But I know what you want me to say, but I'm going to stick true to my promise. I didn't really care so much when Ken Starr moved from investigating savings and loan fraud,
right, exactly,
to sex with interns. And I really don't care very much whether Donald Trump paid off a porn star to keep her quiet. And I think there's lots of ways to remedy that problem. And I think the voters can kind of figure out whether or not they don't like. I mean, I made a list of adjectives here: misogynist, deceitful, crude behavior. You know, there's no adjective you can throw at me that I probably wouldn't agree with about this president. But who was fooled prior to this election? So I really do think that when you talk about weaponizing, I don't know what we're weaponizing. When you talk about weaponizing political conflict, and you say we're going to have a special prosecutor who's outside the normal checks and balances of the Department of Justice, the executive branch, and civilian control of the legal system and the justice system, and you're going to weaponize it in that way, it needs to be limited. It shouldn't be heat-seeking missiles, searching for something to charge. I have the same criticism, actually, of my good friend Pat Fitzgerald and where the Scooter Liberty prosecution ended. You're right, lying to prosecutors is a bad thing, but was that really what that prosecution was supposed to be about? Was that really the evil that was being sought to be protected in that prosecution? And so again, in the theme of sounding a note of caution, be careful what you wish for. You know, today's Bob Mueller is tomorrow's Ken Starr. And aren't there, you know, and aren't there way other ways to deal with this problem?
Actually,
that are less
the only thing is, Bill, it's kind of it's actually the opposite. Yesterday's Ken Starr, Robert Mueller is the Ken Starr, because there's a weird kind of a symmetry going on where Ken Starr did start talking. He picked up from Robert Fisk, Whitewater and this complex land deal and savings and loan, and it ends up with Paula Jones and Monica Lewinsky, and we have the situation now where we've got this whole complexity of like collusion and Russia and this, and it's kind of hard to figure out exactly what's going on. And it's ended up with a porn star, a Playboy model, and some strippers. So there's an odd kind of a potential mirroring between the Clinton and the Trump investigations.
But I feel obligated to say, the fact is that John Edwards was indicted for a similar situation in which money was paid, hush money was paid, and now the flip side of that is that a jury did not convict him. But there, you know, were legitimate legal questions about whether you have a gift that benefits the candidate, how that affects our campaign finance laws, illegal activity, and there's been a history of examination, even of Supreme Court justices back in the day in the 1960s, about whether people could give those sorts of benefits to people who were in high office or seeking high office, and whether there was sufficient disclosure, whether there was illegal activity going on.
Okay, we've got 4 minutes.
One last point on that.
All right.
And by the way, I'm really now just talking about the full power and majesty of the United States criminal justice enforcement system. I also serve on the Colorado Independent Ethics Commission. I was a chair of that commission. So we adjudicate complaints where, you know, some poor county clerk someplace gets a Denver Broncos T-shirt and it's worth more than $59. And the question is, does that, you know, corrupt their exercise of their discretion? So I get the idea of sort of, you know, ethics in government, and I'm not don't mean to downplay that. All I'm trying to do is say, be careful about when and where and how you want to spend your capital to provoke a constitutional crisis. My God, we're here talking about what happens if the Attorney General refuses to do what he's been instructed to do, and what happens if everybody quits. And, you know, I'd have that fight over some things are worth dying for and some things are just worth fighting for. And payoffs to porn stars is worth fighting for, but it's not worth dying for. And I wouldn't provoke a constitutional crisis over that.
Okay. We have 2 or 3 minutes left. And I want to sneak in one last kind of capstone question. Steve Bannon told the Washington Post yesterday that executive privilege, quote, should be exerted immediately and retroactively, which he said would create, quote, a new legal battleground for Trump to protect himself from the investigation. I'm not going to ask you specifically about that, but I want us to go down the line, and I want you to comment briefly on what you see as the greatest looming constitutional and or legal question that we may see as a result of this.
One issue I'm worried about is if Robert sort of alluded to it, if there were an effort to replace Rosenstein or fire Rosenstein, and if somehow Trump wanted to get rid of Sessions so as to get someone more hospitable to deep sixing whatever report comes out, there's a way to do it, and it's somewhat unsettling, and I want you all to be sort of aware of it. There's something called the Federal Vacancies Act, by which a president, by which if there's a vacancy in a Senate-confirmed position, such as the Attorney General, if there's a vacancy, the president can simply put someone in there who has already been confirmed for something else and bypass any Senate confirmation. I hope I made that clear. So in other words,
He did that with CFPB.
Right. We don't have to say, I won't confuse things with that. But if he fired Sessions and then wanted to put either Scott Pruitt or some other person who would be in somewhat indebted to Trump, Trump could bypass the Senate, and that, I think, is a very serious problem. The way the argument against it would be to say, and this is an unresolved question, does the Federal Vacancies Act apply when the president fires someone, or does it simply apply when the vacancy occurs from somehow natural attrition? I would argue that it shouldn't apply when the president has created the vacancy by firing someone. But that's an unanswered question, and it is a way that Trump could get someone more hospitable to him into the Attorney General's office, and that would be a way of possibly squelching whatever Mueller comes up with. That's what I lose sleep over.
Robert, do you...
Just very, very quickly, and we touched upon it before, will Republicans have spine if it does get to the point where the president is about to, or if he actually follows through with firing Mueller, you know, either under the pretext we were talking about, if there's cause, under the pretext that the initial FBI investigation was tainted, and therefore everything Mueller has done subsequently is tainted, will Republicans hold him accountable? And that's the open question.
Recognizing that the Constitution sets out the rules for when someone can be accused of treason, very specifically to prevent reckless accusations of treason, I'm going to go out on the limb and just reaffirm what I said at the beginning, which is that I'm deeply concerned that we have a president who is beholden to a foreign power and is not putting our interests first for reasons that have not yet fully been illuminated, and it concerns me deeply, both for our domestic security and for our national foreign security.
If I had to put my finger on what I think is the most troublesome, worrisome constitutional issue that I see from my vantage point, is the erosion of our way of resolving legal disputes using the rule of law, the constant assault. I'm going to lay blame in both places here. This is why I'm a bad politician. The constant assault on the judiciary by the president, I think, is more than distasteful. I think it undermines our Constitution. It undermines our ability to resolve disputes.
And I think Sue wants to get
by
one
the
more.
Same token.
Yeah, sorry.
The courts have been asking for it, and the gerrymandering decision that's up in the Supreme Court right now. If you go back and read the original decision, and I think it was Baker versus Carr, and you read Justice Frankfurter's dissent where he says this decision, the court's injecting itself into this uniquely political environment we will pay for this for decades to come, because when the population perceives the court as a political actor, then the gloves come off, and we see that every day. And the judicial restraint is not a catchphrase for lawyers. Judicial restraint, there are important constitutional reasons for the courts to exercise restraint. So if that, to me, is one of the most difficult constitutional issues.
Tim said I could say one more thing. Two things that keep me up at night, in addition to what I just mentioned, is... one, the bipolar media, where we all have different, we have two different views of the truth, and the country is just, one side watches one set of facts and the other side watches something else. And that's really dangerous for our democracy. But the other thing that's really dangerous for our democracy is gerrymandering. So I disagree with Bill. I think we have to have the courts come in here so that we don't have politicians dividing up the government and creating safe seats so that no one has to compromise in Congress. That was...
And the one last thing I would like to say is, just to follow up on what Sue said, the phrase that she just used, I think, was absolutely perfect, because speaking as somebody who has had to cover this administration and dealing with tweets and things like that, describing us as a bipolar media, I think, is perfect, is in all senses of the term.